We begin to tease this out a bit this month. And this morning, the consideration is mind as a principle, a faculty, and as an entity. You know, the popular view of the mind is extremely mysterious.
This meeting is being recorded.
Whether you take it from the viewpoint of science or psychology or religion, it's mysterious at best. We need everybody to mute, please. Thank you. In terms of the overall concept, some of us in the popular culture think about Plato's old premise that ideas rule the world, that we live in our minds. And we know through popular culture, we see billboards on occasion, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. We know from medical offices that it's mind over matter, frequently in self-healing programs. And there are those among us that hold with the notion that the brain, the physical brain itself, is the source of thinking, of mind, of ideation. And then there are others among us that are squabbling pretty consistently over whether the mind of an individual is from nurture, the environment, or is it from nature, heredity through parents? So those are some of the popular points of view. They're fraught with mysteries in themselves. They're all efforts to understand the mystery of mind, and mind is as it applies to human beings in particular. It might be helpful to consider at the outset together that when we have a presentation of the fundamentals, you'll frequently hear the phrase that the fundamentals are actually about one premise, one proposition in three different aspects. The same might be said about the issue of mind. It is said that there's a oneness of mind. It may have different applications, different aspects, but mind is one. Another analogy we might be able to use as a touch point to consider this subject is the entire hydrologic cycle, the water cycle. Water is, and we know scientifically we've got H2O, and that governs the drop as well as the ocean. But we know that in addition to this ethereal reality of hydrogen and oxygen, there is also a power manifest in water on our physical plane. It manifests under different conditions of temperature. We can see gas, liquid, ice. We can see the power of a drop in the erosion of the Grand Canyon. We can see the amazing power in the totality of the ocean. And we see a range, don't we? Water is one, but there's a range of manifestation. There's a range of transitory presentments. Water might be pure. It might be polluted. It might be brackish, slightly salty, or it may be boldly salt, as in the ocean. So if we keep in mind those lines of thinking that there's oneness and yet there's diversity within and without that oneness, we can turn to considering mind in the light of theosophy. So let's take mind as a principle first. Mind is a cosmic, universal principle. It's an element. It is an original essence. It is the basis of all the differentiations upon which all applications of thought, ideation, and the force of mind is based. Theosophy presents the idea that the entire universe, and therefore man, as above, so below, everything is sevenfold. There are seven principles, if you will. There are seven of these original essences or planes of understanding of reality. And so, whether we consider mind universally or in the human state, we are considering it as one of those aspects or principles upon which man, the entire notion of what is human, is based. And some others might be the divine, the spiritual, the psychic, the astral, the physiological, if you want. In theosophy, we say that mind is the fifth principle, the fifth constituent in this array of seven principles available both to the cosmos and to the human. Mind, as manas, this fifth principle, is the potentiality, the power, if you will, the force of being able to know, being able to perceive. In the human kingdom, it is the thinker, it is the self-conscious thinker. We know frequently in the philosophy, we see that manas, mind, the fifth principle, can be allied with buddhi, the spiritual discernment or soul, and it can be allied with the kamic principle of desire. But about 18 million years ago, we are told through legend and glyph and spiritual teachings across the ages that the basic monad, the oneness of existence, the oneness of potential intelligence was lit up within the human state. And therefore, we have in the human soul this principle that is a link between the divine and the personal natures of man. So, mind is the fifth principle is one, but there's an array, if you will, of manifestation, ranging from the latent or inactive all the way to the active potentiality at the cosmic level and at the human level. Now, manas, looked at from a slightly different angle, in the philosophy, manas can also be seen as the faculties of that thinking entity that we call the human soul. Right now, we're told in this period of evolution, we're relatively incomplete. Yes, we have this principle within us in potential. Yes, we have some faculties, some applications. Or some tools or vehicles with which to use the mind. But that is still in potential. At this point in our evolution, both as individuals and as part of a collective, the kamic principle, the desire principle, is extremely forceful, full-fledged, and therefore colors the use of the manas. Fifth principle, the thought principle, the mind principle. Taken from the lower powers or faculties that we've got in mind, we know that the human is capable of far more than animal instinct. The human is capable of overcoming animalistic impulse or instinct. In this self-conscious state of mind, from even the very lowest aspects, soul can exhibit in any incarnation degrees of memory, can function from memory, can use reason and logic as faculties, as powers, can move mentally from a premise to a conclusion, oftentimes in a heartless manner, just cool, rational thought, just cognition re going along a particular spectrum. In this state, in this lower state, we see that mind is capable of free will and choice within the conditions that are available. And that at the stage where we are, in the lower use of these faculties, the use of mind, the use of reason, can be overwhelmed by personal desire, passions, volition. And the lower use of that mind can also be tremendously distracted, if you will, by the function of memory. We know it's difficult to use these lower faculties in a concentrated, serious, kind of intentional way. The mind has a tendency in these lower faculties to fly off the handle, to fly to a subject that's pleasurable, or a subject that's painful, or in some other way to fly beyond what the thinker, what the soul would intend for the use of mind. But there are higher faculties. There are higher aspects to the use of mind in the human state. And these higher activities help to prove that it is mind, manas, that uses the brain, that the brain is not the source of mind, and that these higher faculties, sometimes called soul powers, are available to each and all if we would create the circumstances with which to use them. So when you think about imagination used in an altruistic way, empathy, compassion, almost thinking with the heart, if you will. If you think about creative ideation, in which there's a self-fulfilling prophecy, a child who's being abused or neglected or brainwashed in a prejudiced classroom, such a child can, by use of free will and choice, by this higher faculty of intuition and direct cognition, such a child who's very strong can say to himself or herself, I'm creating a different idea. I know within that I am, and that I am a spark of something far higher than what I'm hearing from these adults. And I'm going to overcome the limits that they would put on me. I'm going to be blooming and doing me in terms of these higher aspirations. So, imagination, willful concentration, intuition, direct perception. Memory is a reminiscence, not a recall, not an automatic, flitting monkey mind kind of memory, but reminiscence where we have a sense moment to moment, wait a second, I can see into this problem or this event. Been here before. There are possible solutions, and I can be part of the solution. I can become the solution. I can assist and empower the other. This kind of clear thinking, clear listening, open-heartedness that comes with ethical living, with self-examination, with meditation. All of this is among the highest faculties that mind is capable of. And in those highest faculties, if we persist, with a degree of universality and a degree of loving kindness, we can impress all of matter. We do it through the astral, certainly, but the root source is the mind thinking with the heart. And that brings us to the last mystery for this morning's presentation, is mind as an entity. Well, if we see that there is a principle exhibiting itself in different faculties or potential powers in the human state, who's doing that? Where is the mind that's the creative force? Is it the personality? No, that changes all the time. Is it the physical brain? No, that can be badly damaged. And yet and still, there are those that can rise above the brain damage and continue to create and perform in a thoughtful, mindful, self-reflective way. So theosophy offers this premise as a mystery to the mind, that manas is actually an entity, that it is eternal, that it is both cosmic and individualized in the human state to its highest point in this evolution. That manas as an entity is a reincarnating entity. It is a trinity of spirit, of soul, of mind essence. It's a triad of higher principles. Atma, number seven, Buddhi, number six, and Manas, number five. That Manas, as this eternal entity, only becomes dual, only becomes trapped or enmeshed, if you will, in the physicality of an incarnation. And becomes aware of these higher faculties and those lower faculties only when incarnate, only within the flesh. And we have a proposal in the philosophy that truly is a promise for each and every human soul born on this planet under any condition, that each is in potential, completely mindful and perfectible within the confines of our evolutionary period. One can become enlightened. One can become masterful. And we have examples of these Mahatmas, these truly great ones, walking among all peoples of the earth, raising up cultures across time. And if we compare their teachings, we see that they're actually mindful of a particular form of eternal verities. We know that this duality that we work through has a life of its own. The personalized, kamamanasic, individualized mind could roll on automatically. It could begin to turn in focus to something higher and more altruistic, more collective, more universal, the Buddhi monastic. But overriding those manifestations, overriding the process of evolving from the monadic essence of oneness through all of the different applications of incarnations and expressions, returning to that monadic essence with a self-proclaimed, self-created effort to raise up all degrees of life and consciousness. That generator of true thought, that highest abstraction of mind, of manas, is ideation, its force. It makes a physical and a mental link between the lowest physicality we can imagine and the highest divinity that we can imagine. That entity is made up of, it's sustained by all thought. And people understand it in different ways. Some talk about the Holy Spirit, others talk about angels. You might hear the more scientific talk about spiritual force. But these are all terms for the entity of mind. And as students of the philosophy, we're invited to research some Eastern terms because English is very limited. You might want to research Mahat as the source of all, Kshitrajna, embodied spirit, Tejasi, a radiant mind, a thought body that's generated by spiritual force and energy. And throughout all, we're invited to consider alone and together that there is a thread state. There is mind across all times. There is mind in development. This is a process, not a journey, not a destination. It's a path. And it's one that we not only share despite our peculiar uses of mind, we share it with every single soul on the face of the earth. Now, I'm sure that you came to March with your own considerations of the mystery of mind, and perhaps on this morning's title as well, Principle, Faculty, and Entity. SL?
So we've heard that mind as entity is the knower, the witness, the observer, the perceiver. And yet there's a mystery about this term perceiver, because in the writings of HPB and William Q. Judge, we see the perceiver is sometimes referred to as the higher self or Atma. So how can it be that it's a universal self, the perceiver, and yet at the same time an individual entity? Because it depends how we use the term, it can be confusing.
Even the word monad can be confusing as well, because we talk about the monad coming forth from this abstract absolute principle that's the source of all, but we also talk about the monad Atma Buddhi that's in all the lower kingdoms, and then that gets lit up with manas for the human state. So we struggle with these ideas, but we're led back to there is this oneness in this unknowable, absolute, abstract reality that is eternal, that is changeless, has no attributes, and yet emanating from it, radiating from it. We could use so many different words for being the expressions of mind and spirit that are coming forth from that, and then gradually going from the most ethereal state of reality all the way down into the incorporation in the physical that we perceive about us. So if we have the perceiver, we've got a ray of this power and potentiality. Mind is a principle. It endows certain functions or faculties. And then in the personal, we have this radiant or this spot, if you will, this individualization of mind in the human soul that comes forth in any incarnation. The power's there in potential, but the power is like a light bulb that is blocked by a lampshade. We don't see the full force of the electricity that is the source, the true one source of the light. We see perhaps a bit of the light as it's functioning in the condition of the light bulb, And then, depending on the shade that we put on top of the lamp, on top of the light bulb, we have a diminished degree of light that can be expressed in the room. We even have shadows that are created. So we can see in that analogy the oneness of the electricity, the source, the force, the oneness of the power, and then it comes all the way down. It's expressed in a particular vehicle, the light bulb. The light bulb can be contained or curtailed by a lamp shade. Then there's the perception of the light that's left in the room and the possibility of seeing shadows, reflections of that limited light. Thought is exactly the same way. That highest entity is closest to the universal. It is pure as the white light. It is akin to the electricity. And then it begins to be expressed like the light bulb. There is a particular instrument. Theosophy tells us it's created by our own past causes, by skandhas that we've attracted for ourselves. And so we come into this light, this life, with a particular condition that can express a portion of the universal. We perceive according to the limits of those skandhic tendencies that we're using, and we can fool ourselves. We can erect shades or veils that limit those perceptions and carry in themselves effects, shadows that can further confuse our perceptions. So the oneness of the perception is there. The very highest potential of Buddhi Manas and beyond, close to that abstract Atman, is there. But according to law, it is conditioned, it is made finite, and then it's used in the light of desire, and that changes the perception. Do you have a follow-up, SL? I'm talking too long.
No, we think, but no, the gist of the idea was very clear and illuminating that the perceiver as can be sort of as a universal power to know present in all the kingdoms, and yet it is individualized in the human because of the awakening of the principle of individual self-conscious mind.
And in that self-conscious mind is the creation that sets up duality. I can do the best I can imagine for the good of all, or I can choose to use the same energy, the same power to do the dearest for I, me, my. And those choices further limit and hamper the use of that lowest application of mind. Theosophy Hall, I think I saw a hand.
So Manas is eternal. However, we're also told that Manas isn't present during certain cycles. Is there a calculation to determine when Manas might arrive at our present cycle, according to Judge's Ocean of Theosophy?
In terms of when Manas is set to arrive, the monastic principle is eternal. It is consciousness. There's a study you could do about Kriya Shakti being this very high level degree of universality of power. In all of the theosophical documents that this student has read so far, the lighting up of Manas, the conditioning of Manas in the human state, happened 18 million years ago. Now, the fly in the ointment is this: everything universally operates under law. There's a symmetry of karma, isn't there? There's a balancing of cause and effect. So while Manus was lit up as a potentiality 18 million years ago, there is a range of karmic filters or lampshades, if you will, for how that can be expressed and used. Manus is, the expressions are infinite. So in this situation, based on past incarnations and prior periods of manifestation in other global chains, the philosophy tells us that past causes are brought over into this period of manifestation. There are souls that have walked among us and are on the planet still, who are incredibly enlightened. They're very, very advanced. Their ability to center themselves in the monastic force and use the desire principles in the ethical proper way, their use of power is tremendous because they are an expression of all past endeavors that they've set up as souls in the past. There are others who are just young souls. They are just emerging into a scenario where self-consciousness, mindful living, ethical applications, the highest use of reason from premise to conclusion is done in a not an intellectual cold way, but in a heartfelt, compassionate way. The monastic principle is one. That particular young soul's ability to use it is hampered, perhaps. And we're told there are numbers, I can't even pronounce some of these numbers that are in the ocean, that eventually what's going to happen with the force of our individualized and collective efforts, eventually what's going to happen is that the monastic, the creative force of spiritual consciousness, will overwhelm and will become higher and higher. Kama will become a balanced principle and will be diminished and be able to be used in the loftiest of ways. And that will come according to the efforts that the collective set up. We're in the Kali Yuga. Things are moving quickly. We're perplexed by what we see around us. We're perplexed by what we experience each day. But we know that moment by moment, in these little moments of, I will endeavor to do better. I will endeavor to best serve the whole. It's in those moments that we trigger the duration of when the monastic will fully be able to be expressed by one and all. Theosophy Hall?
Yes, so it's the individualized mind which ensouls the human being, and each human being, by definition, is an individual. But human beings can choose, so to speak, can choose to act as one mind. And in doing so, is there something they're giving up by doing so, or is there something in point of fact to be gained by acting with others as one mind? Or is that just an expression?
Interesting question. That choice, that insight that I can either continue to think with faculties that focus on I, me, my, and I can continue to live my life in protection of whatever materialistic safety I may have. I can constrict my sense of self in that way. That's one thing. But what happens when we really constrict? The pupils of the eyes contract completely. They see far less. If we constrict our hand and make a fist and we're holding on to something, we have lost the use, the full use of those hands in that grasping. If we choose instead to enlarge our sense of self and to forget about a personal insult, forget about different points of view of interpretation of something. But if we choose to look into the eyes of the other and see that there's the same soul in potential looking back at us, that we're one. If we lose the constriction, what is it when we give that constriction up? What do we gain? We gain an open heart, an open head, open hands. We gain an incredibly blissful existence of a namaste moment in which we can look beyond the wrinkles of whatever just happened with another, and we can create a spiritual sense we are one, we can get through this together, we can respect the thinking of each other, and we can find the commonality because universality is the truth. Universal brotherhood, oneness in nature, spiritual, mental, physical. Oneness is the true reality, and we gain everything. We gain absolutely everything in that effort to commune, to celebrate the oneness. We lose nothing. SL?
So that principle of mind was lit up 18 million years ago. And for the majority of humans at this time, because of the prevalence and influence of kamma or desire, we're mostly operating through lower mind. Although it is said that we are also in a certain stage of our evolution in the next several hundred thousand years, where the humanity in general will evolve, where there will be even a higher use of that mind. But the full incarnation and use of the mind that's inherent in that reincarnating ego won't occur till the next great period of evolution, what we call around, and that's so many millions of years hence. And that's the mystery to us. We just don't have those figures. But we are told we should be able to see around us evidences of the awakening of consciousness within our fellow human beings, a greater awareness through the use of their mind. And that produces revolutions as much as it does innovations.
When we see it, a really rugged era in history, and we can look at cycles of histories and cycles of nature, revolutions and turmoil and disagreements and arguments, great periods of suffering. We could choose to sit and be paralyzed and look at this recurrence and say, what the Harry's is going on? Haven't we learned anything at all in 18 million years? Or we could think about the way a chick emerges from an egg. The egg is its total reality. It is a protective period of development, fully nurtured, fully encapsulated, safe from most of the threats of life because of the caretakers around it. But what happens when it's time for that chick to emerge into a whole nother level of existence, and a level of existence in which there is mobility and the instinct and a certain freedom. Well, that chick has to go through the pain and the agony. It has to be exhausting to peck through all the layers inside the egg and then begin to peck apart the eggshell itself until finally it can emerge. So if we look around the world and we're disheartened at these recurring periods of revolution and animosity and war, we can be pretty sure that what we're witnessing together is the death of a particular paradigm, the struggle to be free, that there's actually a common cause that everyone shares, a struggle to be free, a struggle to be self-expressive, a struggle to be able to care for their beloveds, to be compassionate and curing for all they encounter. That struggle to be free is a period that we move through. We recognize, because we're eternal perceivers, wait a second, if I can see the difference between the inside of the egg and the outside of the egg, if I can begin to make a proposition about what life was in potential inside the egg and then outside the egg, if I'm observing these recurring revolutionary cycles, but I can still perceive there's a oneness in the mind watching all this that's above, far away and above all the personal turmoil and all of the destruction of the old and the creation of the new. What I'm seeing is theosophical movement of one eternal mind choosing, I can be a witness, I can join in empathy with any human being and uplift them, assist in their thinking. But I am, and I can overcome all of those differences. It's ongoing. It's unfolding. There's no ultimate perfection. There are spiraling cycles of life. We share them. Some of us are choosing to remain as unconscious as possible, to mesmerize themselves with, you know, leisure time activities, and others are not. Others are in the middle of the hot pursuit, but they're trapped in their passions and desires. And still others of us will choose to be contemplative, to be observant, to be open-minded, to be meditative, will choose to try to be mindfully one in order to soothe transitions. Big task. Starts with tiny little efforts.
There's a chat.
Oh, thank you. Let me try to get to it. Do our thoughts come from our mind or from our brain? Well, you know what? We see evidence. The physical brain functions through the nervous system. It responds to stimuli from outside. But most of us have seen the mysteries of hypnosis, in which one human being can mesmerize or hypnotize another and block the consciousness of the brain and use the astral to set up new stimuli. But what goes on there? There's still a perceiver, somewhat paralyzed perhaps, working through presumptions. And given a hypnotic suggestion, that perceiver can really think that they've sustained a burn on their skin. that they're on fire, that something horrible has happened, because under the hypnotic influence, the brain is paralyzed. It can't transmit sensations completely, and an ice cube placed on the skin can be reinterpreted by the mind entity that this isn't ice cold, this is fire, I'm burned. So the mind can overcome great limitations. There are medical cases in which infants who were born with cerebral palsy and then sustain a horrible stroke before they're 2 or 3 years old may take a lifetime, 50, 60 years, to find out that actually half of their physical brain is completely dead and dwindled. The other half of the physical brain is all they've got, and yet they've graduated from an Ivy League institution. They've functioned through a career as an accountant. So the mind, the force of the skandhas of that mind have overcome tremendous limitations of the brain power. So mind is, it's an ideation, it's a force, and the brain itself is a tool. But even having said that, the soul is, and manas is an instrument. Mind is an instrument used by the spiritual soul, just like we would use a telescope. SL?
We've read in the philosophy that the lower mind especially requires the brain to work through on this plane, and that specifically it's the cerebral cortex that polishes the thoughts generated by the mind. And when we think of the term polishing, it allows us to see much more clearly that which already is there. It doesn't add anything, but it refines the impression so it can be seen more clearly. And it reminded us of this modern scientific field of neuroplasticity. It's repeatedly demonstrated that through the practice of certain mental and even physical exercises, the brain itself changes the physical brain, and they can confirm this with scans and so forth. The physical brain changes so that the thought becomes clearer, more focused, our memory becomes better, our expressions of those faculties becomes more clearly. But it begins with our effort as thinkers, but it manifests in the brain.
And that is relatively new scientific information. You can research for yourself the work of scientists like Dr. Amen or Amen, Amen, who has done a lot of research with scans and different medical practices, helping people with all sorts of levels of brain damage and brain disease. And this is very different from 70 years ago. 70 years ago, we were still being taught that there was no hope. The brain did not regenerate its cells, that the brain was the control center, and once damaged, too bad, it was lights out. There were scores, thousands, maybe millions of children who were born into physical brains that, they were just said to be throwaways. They just, it, nothing was going to change. Nothing could happen for them. Put them away, make them wards of the state. The very wealthy put them into care homes, holding pens, if you will. And in today's world, 70 years later, if we look into the modern scientific research, we know that whole thing was fallacious. And again, it was, what was taught and accepted in popular thought became the handicapping feature. What could have been in today's parlance, what is now, is in potential tremendous, absolutely tremendous. So, as self-conscious thinkers, we can recreate the brain that we're using Then there's the entire mystery that while everybody worries about the physical brain, there's an astral brain, there's astral senses. Theosophy Hall.
Yes, go ahead.
Well, all this considered, and yeah, the plasticity of what they've shown with the plasticity of the brain is truly amazing. But that also speaks to the requirements that were set for Pythagoras School in Crotona and for Plato's Academy, that for admission, you have to demonstrate, before you even get in there, you have to demonstrate confidence that you have trained your brain in the different areas of learning, in mathematics, in music, in ways of, in literature, et cetera, or rhetoric, we should say. So it's clear that as theosophy, I mean, just as a student of theosophy, we can see that continuous education of oneself, and yes, training the brain is always going to help us to learn and apply theosophy in certain ways that were we did we not put ourselves through that education, school or no school, diploma or no diploma, purposely moving forward with one's individual education is always going to help us to understand more about life and to understand the philosophy, it would seem.
Thank you.
Yeah, lifelong learning. And it takes courage, doesn't it? In order to be a seeker of truth, the courage is, all right, in my home life, in my formative years, I was taught a particular line of thinking, a particular belief system. Didn't seem to hold up when I became an adult and I began practicing adulting, as the kids say now. And it takes courage to look at what we thought was true, open up our minds and take in new information, and then create a whole new reality, a whole new platform from which we can spring forth. And that early mystery school at Pythagoras's direction did set up particular lines for how to care for the physical body, how to care for the astral body, how to care for the intellectual, how to use these principles in a particular way, and then practice a period of silence. A period of information gathering, listening, and then gradually, like the chicken, to burst out of the little eggshell. You may find reading the introduction to The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, very interesting because she sets up parameters to consider the mind and the brain, thought and consciousness, man and nature. As opposed to deity, it's quite an introduction, and we are out of time. So, Wednesday night, we'll get together. It will be a hybrid session. The building will be open again, and we'll also be on Zoom. And on Wednesday, March 5th, we'll be considering the after-death states, the natural separations of the principles. What does happen to that mind? Another mystery. Have a great week.
Bye, everybody.